Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 27th, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me, as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
Yes, and Catherine, I'm going to give you credit on this one. Catherine booked our guest this week. We have the Young Democrats National President, YDA President, Lewis Elrod, join us. Now, Lewis has been on the show before, but never as the president of the national organization, so we'll be happy to talk to Lewis about 15 minutes into the podcast show, and we'll talk to him about what he's going to do with that organization, and we might can slip a national question or two in on him, right, Catherine?
Yeah, we can talk about Georgia politics, too. He's pretty well informed, so he'll be alive.
Well, I tell you what. Oh yeah. Well, in pre-show we were talking about the coroner's position in one of Georgia's 159 counties. So to not bore everyone, let's go in the other direction and talk about the Speaker of the House for the whole nation. John Boehner, I think that was quite a surprise. He announced that he was resigning his office, I guess effective of this fall. Not necessarily tomorrow, but it's real soon, and it's kind of setting in motion possibly a real free-for-all. Tim, what are your thoughts on it?
You know, I don't blame him for getting out. It was to the point where there were some in his caucus that were going to start actively trying to remove him, and it was also to the point where they were not going to listen to him. Or to anybody in the leadership, a lot of them thought he was too liberal, if you can believe that. Simply, I guess, because he wouldn't go along with some of this new bunch on every last issue. This new bunch, that's their litmus test, you know. Have they moved so far to the right that they think he's too liberal? One of those new congressmen from Kentucky almost called him a traitor or something to the country. I don't know. It's sad to see that, but that party is losing its reasonable people, the people that are reasonable enough to, you know, try to get anything done by working with the other side. This newer bunch just don't want to do that. It's only going to get worse, too.
Yeah, I guess he might be liberal when it comes to suntanning, but beyond that, I think he's pretty conservative. It's just that you have to be more and more conservative. I kind of like it. I think it affects both parties. I'm going to be fair here. And I remember when I was growing up, and you still see it today some, you know, you find people at church, and they just were trying to almost out-holy each other, and they just wanted to prove that they were the most righteous. And yeah, and sometimes it came off as just, you know, being maybe more judgmental and things that weren't necessarily godly. I think in our politics today, we are trying to find people that are so pure from whichever party, and I think it does affect the Republican Party more, much more than the Democrats, but I see it some in our primaries too. We have people that are trying to go to the farthest right as we possibly can, and they're getting so far out of the mainstream where the average voter is. Catherine, do you see a little bit of that in our politics, and do you think that's what possibly brought John Boehner down?
I do think that's what brought John Boehner down, and I think he probably just got so frustrated with it. You know, I think he's been around long enough to know what has to happen in order for anything to happen. You know, I think he had a pretty good handle on that, probably, and he was getting a lot of resistance from the further right in his party, so I'm sure he felt frustrated And they were going to gun for him if he didn't resign. I was a little surprised that he resigned the whole thing. I thought maybe he would just step aside as speaker, but I guess he felt like he had to do that. I don't know. That seemed a little surprising to me. But I don't think this, you know, we can, you know, rejoice a little bit, I suppose, but I don't think it really helps us. I think whoever comes in his stead is probably not going to be any more friendly to us than he was. Not that he was that friendly to us, but if you know what I mean.
I
don't think this is good for us, I guess.
Oh, no, I do think, from what they understand, he was always cordial, respected Barack Obama as a man, and Barack Obama respected John Boehner as a man. On a personal level, they had a decent relationship, and so it's very likely
the president was the only one who had anything nice to say. The president was the only one who said anything gracious about his exit.
Oh yeah, and sometimes this happens with adversaries. They have a healthy respect, and they may have just looked at each other as men. And there are very few people in the Republican Party that do that anymore. I think John McCain is somebody in the Republican Party that respects Barack Obama as a man, looks at some of the things that he does, and doesn't worry about that they disagree on politics. And you know, a lot of your Tea Party types, they don't care about things they might admire about the president. They just disagree with him on policy, and that's all that matters. And so that's kind of gets to a very unhealthy situation.
It goes beyond that. You were with me the night that Cokie Roberts was out there at Berry. And you heard what she said. That, you know, when she was growing up, she grew up in Washington. And those guys, they all used to take their families up there with them. And their families all knew each other. Their kids went to school together. They grew up in the same neighborhoods. They actually were friends, even though they were adversaries on the floor. These people genuinely do not like each other anymore. And they don't need to do that, because the more adversarial they are, the better electorally it is for them, because of the way these districts are drawn. Republicans, for instance, in most districts in this country, they don't have to worry about a Democrat. They got to worry about somebody running to the right of them. So what are they going to do? Get as far to the right as they can. And another thing, party leadership, when I was a kid, controlled patronage, for instance, controlled the purse strings and all. None of that's true anymore. Now you got wealthy cats that can go around and just pay for campaigns and stuff, and it's just all different now. Those people genuinely do not like each other, and if you're nice to the other side at all, then you're considered an enemy by especially some of these newer people. And I just don't know what it's going to take to change that, unless a bunch of them are just voted out and agreed up people, and I don't know if that's going to happen.
Oh, yeah, because enough of the parties, you know, the hardcore Republican voters, that's what they want. And so many people that are kind of middle of the road that might lean Republican, they don't come out in the primaries the same way. And so the far right of the party controls the primary. And it just exacerbates the situation. I think it would help some if you had, you know, judicial redistricting and the, you know, the lot, you had more swing districts that then, you know, would produce more moderate both Republicans and Democrats.
Most of these state legislatures won't allow it. It won't happen.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Well, because they have control. The Republicans are in a situation mathematically and demographically, they shouldn't control as much as they control, but they do. And so as long as they can continue to tweak the rules, they can hang on longer than their electorate would allow them to. I mean,
right,
the demographics are, you know, so rapidly changing, but they've stretched more years out of this thing. It's kind of something to see. Well, look, Catherine, have you heard any names on, you know, specific people who may seek the Speaker of the House, or is it going to be just one person?
Oh, I think it's going to be a free-for-all. I think there's going to be a bunch of people, and they're all going to be fighting over it.
Yeah. Tom Price from Georgia, I did hear he's looking at the majority leader spot, so that would put him out as Speaker of the House. But then you have, I guess, whomever the current majority leader is, and I, you know, for some reason, I don't know who that is. Usually I would know who that is. But that person's probably going to try to step up. Does anybody know that name, Tim?
Yeah, it's going to be Kevin McCarthy from California. He's going around quietly now lining up the votes, and he's probably going to ascend to the speakership because some of the more conservative members find him acceptable. I know
even
Paul Ryan,
California.
Paul Ryan took his name out of the running, and that was really the main impediment to McCarthy.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah. Yeah, because because Republicans generally don't trust California. I mean, California, the whole state, they look at it as Hollywood and San Francisco, and they just don't have a use for it. I mean, and there's some Democrats.
Oh, that's not true. That's not really true. There's some ultra conservative parts of California.
Yeah.
Oh, the average person, you know, they just think it's all Hollyweird and the left coast.
Oh yeah,
They don't trust California. Your average voter, I don't think, understands the nuance of there's a lots of parts of California. I mean, Death Valley is nothing like, San Francisco, and you have the Fertile Crescent where all the food's grown, and that's nothing like Los Angeles and stuff like that. But they just paint it all with one brush. That'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see what Kevin McCarthy does with the speakership. And I guess, given that California's pretty Democratic on a statewide level, I wonder if he would help. It would be quite a tall order, but help bring that state a little more right-leaning. Tim, any chance of that?
No. I tell you what, he's going to have his hands full with them crazies up there, and I actually feel sorry for the man. I can understand wanting the power of that office, but he's also going to get the headaches that come with it because there's just some of that bunch that he's not going to be able to do anything with. Just like Boehner couldn't do nothing with some of them. I said, there's a bunch of them wanting to shut the government down right now and got mad at Boehner because he wasn't going to do it.
Yep. And so, we'll see how that government shutdown, what happens there. Speculation's running now that they may not shut it down, but we shall see. And then, of course, that could be a short-term fix in the next three-month business cycle comes up, and who knows what will happen. Well, a story we kind of talked about last week, I postulated the question to Matt Wyatt, why in the world is Kim Davis a Democrat since all these Republicans were defending her and her principles seem to fit better with their party? And I guess Kim Davis got the word that we thought that on the Kudzu Vine, and she went ahead and switched. Catherine, did you have a big morning party for that?
Oh, yeah, you know me. I mean, it's a logical change for her. So, good for her. Whatever.
Yeah, I don't think we'll really miss her that spot. I mean, we always hate to lose any user. We hate to lose anything, but that she just didn't fit with where the Democratic Party is and is going, and really where the country's going. I watched Selma on DVD recently, and Lyndon Johnson looks at George Washington and said, I don't want to be seen on the same side of history as you, even at the time, right before that, he was nowhere close to George Washington, still far more progressive. But, I think a lot of people may start to say, I don't want to be seen on the same side of history as Kim Davis and Mike Huckabee and others. Tim, was this just waiting to happen?
Yeah, guy we've had as a guest several times on here, Keith McCants, on his Facebook page the other day, referred to it as the biggest non-story of the week. And actually, nationally, I think he's right. Around the country, people are saying, oh, Kim Davis switch, big surprise. But I go back to something that our guest last week said. He said people are looking that, at that a little bit differently in Kentucky than they would be nationally. And I wonder how all of this with her switching will play out in Kentucky and affect their statewide election, like their governor's race, for instance. I bet this has suddenly become a hot-button issue about an abusive, overreaching government. I'm sure that's the angle they'll use, an abusive, overreaching government attacking our very freedoms, like our religious freedom and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I'm wondering how the average Kentucky, fairly conservative, independent voter that a lot of times votes Democratic in these state elections is going to look at that. Could hurt.
Oh, yeah, I think that's something we miss is there could be some voters in Kentucky that have always voted Democratic that were planning to vote for Jack Conway and somehow see Kim Davis as a hero. And then they say, well, if Kim's switching Republican, what about me? And if a few thousand votes were to move an incredibly close race, it could cost Jack Conway or others, since it's in the same month or the same, I guess, 40-day period, is their governorship will be cast. And that truly would be a shame because, I mean, Jack Conway is a Kentucky Democrat. We do want to see elected. Well, I think our guest is ready to join us. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine, Lewis Elrod.
Hey there. How's everybody doing tonight?
Oh, good. Well, Lewis, since we've talked, I think the last time we talked to you, you were the Democratic or the Young Georgia Democrats president. Now you've ascended or won election as the national president. Tell us about that process.
That's right. So, yes, I think the last time we spoke, I was the president of the Young Democrats of Georgia. That was a couple of years ago. In between that time and now, I've been serving on the national board of the Young Democrats of America as one of the vice presidents, one of the first vice presidents from Georgia in quite some time. And just this past August, I was elected president of the Young Democrats of America at our convention in Los Angeles. That was August 22nd, and quite a process. It's a full campaign. We raised money. We spent time on the phone calling voters, and I traveled all across the country. I think I ended up going to about 20 or 25 states in a 4 to 6 month period, and the full campaign that we put together, I think overall we hit about 36 states all across the country. And we were very very blessed to have been elected with a very healthy margin in Los Angeles.
Well, I mean, that raises some more questions for me. Since it's such a robust campaign, do you hire like a campaign staff or maybe a campaign manager and or consultants like a regular campaigns would do?
We certainly could. Typically how these sorts of campaigns are run with the Young Democrats, and certainly the way we ran ours, was that we absolutely had people who helped us do our communications, do our voter outreach, our fundraising. This was all done on a volunteer basis, and we weren't paying anybody specifically, but we did have a what you could call a full campaign staff assisting me and a slate of other candidates and running this campaign.
Wow. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it around to Catherine and then to Tim for more questions just about the YDs and your post. Catherine?
Hey, Lewis. Thanks for being on tonight. It was great to see you at the dinner last night, too.
Yes, you too.
Tell me about the slate. Just if you could just explain to our listeners and to Tim and David about how the slate works, because the YDs tend to run as a slate. And so tell us about your slate and how that works.
Yes. So the Young Democrats of America, we're a membership organization. We're actually the largest youth progressive political organization in the country. And our governing board is we have a full national committee of between 150 and 200 national committee members, but we also have a board of officers that runs the day-to-day operations of the organization. And those are made up of nine people. Two of those are representatives to the Democratic National Committee. They're elected in a year separate from the other seven. So what we did at the convention in Los Angeles this year was elect a president, an executive vice president, three additional vice presidents, a secretary, and a treasurer. And while it's certainly not required, candidates for office typically do run as a slate. So we put together a slate of candidates, seven candidates from all across the country. We had, for our executive vice president, we've got Constantina Mace. She's from New Jersey, and she is a political operative up there. She actually served as the Women's Caucus Chair for the Young Democrats. And together, she and I put together the rest of our slate. We've got three vice presidents. One of them is from Rhode Island. Her name is Christina Fox. We have another vice president named Danielle Glover. She's from Colorado. She works with she serves on several boards and lobbies around the country. And we also have Daniel Sims from Arkansas serving as a vice president. He's actually my successor. I held that seat before he took that. And as far as secretary and treasurer, our secretary is Quentin Watsumo-Chama from Minnesota. He has the busiest job making sure we keep our minutes and notes up to date. And our treasurer is Drew Pollan from Washington State, who just got his passed the Washington State Bar, so we have a lawyer on the board as well. So as you can see, we have a diverse group of officers from all across the country, and to run an organization like this means you've got to really be a national organization and move around quite a lot and have a lot of opinions from all across the country.
Thanks, Louis. I'm going to pass it to Tim for more questions.
Louis, I'm sure you were asked this on your travels around the country, but I'd like for you to articulate to our listeners, why did you want to be president of the Young Democrats of America?
Well, I there's really only one answer to that, and that's that I've been involved in the Young Democrats for so long. It really has been my outlet for change. What I want to do as as someone in politics, I've been largely doing that through the Young Democrats. I started when I was 16 years old. I've been doing it for 11, 12 years now. So I know that Young Democrats can have a real impact on politics, a real-world impact on politics. I've seen it. I've seen it happen. And now we're going into a huge presidential election where our work means more than ever. It's going to have more of an impact than ever. And I very much want to be a part of that because I've seen it on the local level. I've seen it on the state level and the national level. I want to be there when we make that change. And that's why I decided to run.
Oh, and also for the benefit of our listeners in the presidential election itself next year, how would the work of the Young Democrats of America, what you do, compare to, say, the work that, the Democratic National Committee would be doing at the same time?
Well, we're a much smaller organization than the DNC by far. We are a membership organization, so our chief goal is to elect Democrats where we can, but also train our members and advocate for issues that are important to us, important to our generation. So the work that we do, you see it on the local level. You see it when there's a candidate running for a local, state, or federal office that has 30 or 40 Young Democrats come out and knock on doors. That very well is because a Young Democrats chapter or the state or national organization coordinated fundraising efforts to make that happen. That's where you see our impact. And when you hear about young Democrats writing letters to the editor or lobbying the members of their state legislature on an issue important to them like student loan reform, that's where you see our impact. The Democratic National Committee, of course, has a much, much larger and more involved task at hand.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's an excellent explanation. David?
Yes, well, looking towards the next election, we know in 2008 and certainly some in 2012, younger voters, a lot was made of how more younger voters voted, registered, whatnot, were energized. Do you think it'll be equal, or what can you do to keep the energy up for 2016 from 2008?
Well, that's the work that we have to do. I don't think that there's any I think everybody understands exactly what happened in 2008 and 2012. I mean, 2008 saw the largest bump in youth vote ever since 18-year-olds got the opportunity to first vote back in, you know, several years ago, decades ago. That was a candidate-based bump. There was, you know, momentum. Well, not only was there incredible disillusionment around President Bush. I mean, certainly that's why I got involved in politics. I mean, that's what was driving my political involvement. But we had a dynamic candidate that was incredibly skilled at mobilizing the youth vote. And that's why you had all of these pundits out there saying, like, well, yeah, I mean, President, you know, this candidate Obama seems like, you know, seems pretty great, but you look at the traditional voting models and it's not really that making that much of an impact. Well, Obama changed the electorate. He not only did it in 2008, he repeated it in 2012. And that's a testament to the work that OFA has done, both in 08 and 2012, you know, the work that they've put in. Now, the Young Democrats of America, we've traditionally been a very big part of doing that. The way the organization stands now, though, we've got to make sure that we're making sure our machinery is working very well. What I mentioned earlier about having local chapters supporting local candidates and young people lobbying their legislators, et cetera, and us training young people, that's what we're going to be focusing on, because we won't be able to have much of an impact anywhere if we don't make sure that our members are supported, that our members understand that they're a part of our organization and they can get our support. Going into 2016, I honestly don't know what the youth vote is going to look like. Certainly we're going to be supporting the Democratic nominee and what that campaign wants to do as far as YDA involvement. I mean, we'll certainly be there to do that. But as far as our organization making a huge impact on the youth vote itself, I know that someday we'll get there, but that's not going to be us going into 2016.
Yes, one more question on YDA talk before I pass it around for Catherine and Tim again. How much do you interact with the Young Republicans as a part of your position?
You know, actually not very much. I've headed up several Young Democratic organizations at the University of Georgia, for example, also the statewide organization here, as you mentioned earlier. I don't think we interacted very much with them while I was state president. And at the college level, all the time, the college Republicans and the Young Democrats were agreed to disagree, did debate. They understood that what was good for both of us was good for the school itself and students itself. So we were able to partner together on student engagement at the college level. Currently, I haven't had much interaction with the Young Republicans, although they did congratulate me. The Georgia Young Republicans congratulated me on on my whim, so that was very nice of them. I was also paying close attention to the National Young Republicans presidential race. We had a candidate from Georgia who was running for that, Megan Hansen, but she ended up not winning that one.
Yes, well, I'll go ahead and pass it to Catherine, then to Tim on Young Democrat Democrats questions, and then we may ask you a few political things. Catherine?
Well, what do you – I don't know what to say. I don't know what to ask. What would you like to tell us about the Young Democrats of America?
Well,
and how
certainly.
Yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit?
Sure. Well, we do have a lot of exciting things that are coming up. So we're essentially running the organization between now and August of 2017. There's a lot coming up for us that we want to do. We already told you about the – I already mentioned the impact that we want to have on the local level. But we want to make sure that this organization is worthwhile to our members, but also worthwhile to people who want to support the Young Democrats and as well as candidates who are out there looking for support. So the first thing that we're doing immediately is we're having a national meeting in Des Moines, Iowa, in the middle of November, November 13th through the 15th. And that's going to be an amazing opportunity. It's going to be the first time in years that the Young Democrats of America has had a meeting in an early primary state or caucus state ahead of the presidential election. So we're looking to learn a lot more about the caucus process in Iowa, but also do our best to interact with surrogates of presidential campaigns and learn more about that presidential process. Hopefully it's not going to be too cold in November.
It's
going
to be cold.
In Iowa. Well, I went to a wedding there in December, and I vowed never to go back in December. It was the coldest I've ever been in my life, but maybe it'll be a little bit warmer in November.
You can hope.
I do.
And then once the election is over, you'll have almost another year. So do you use that in-between time for building your base and and so, okay, well, that makes sense. That is
absolutely it. They're off years, essentially, like 2015 and what 2017 will be. You wouldn't so much call them rebuilding as much as boosting up. I'm sure those of us who have been involved in local politics understand that people get involved a lot. People come out of the woodwork before big elections, especially presidential elections. And the same thing happens to Young Democratic chapters. We have people who, never bother going to a meeting before, suddenly becoming interested, finding politics and showing up and doing all of that work. And it's the duty of our chapters to make sure that we retain those people so that we don't, we don't take a serious hit in fundraising and activity when there's no election around. So in odd numbered years, that's when states and local chapters do what they can to build up their membership and get ready for the next election.
Okay. Tim?
Lewis, kind of along that same vein, do the various state Young Democratic organizations possess the resources necessary to have a viable outreach program at the local level that you've been speaking of?
It absolutely varies state to state. And that's the job of the national organization, to make sure that the newer, younger, weaker states have that capacity. I will say that we have some incredible states in the organization who have done had a huge impact. I would first of all say that the Young Democrats of Georgia it's one of the most active chapters in the country, and the work that they did on Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter's race last year was phenomenal. I think it was I think this is absolutely incredible, seeing the level of activity that the young Democrats were able to engage in, especially in a non-presidential year here in Georgia. So we made a big impact here in Georgia. Also, I've been mentioning this quite a bit, especially going around the country. The young Democrats of North Carolina, they put together something that is pretty much the model for what young Democrats can do. They had a younger candidate running against an incumbent Republican state legislator, and that campaign was run by young Democrats. They put together what we call campaign invasions, a weekend of field work, door-to-door phone banking that had, I think, between 30 and 50 young Democrats show up and knock on doors. And the numbers they got out of that were incredible, and that candidate won. That Democrat knocked out an incumbent Republican. And when I went back to North Carolina a few months later, I saw the campaign manager on a panel saying, we would not have been able to do this. We would not have been able to win without the young Democrats of North Carolina. So we absolutely do have the ability to make a big impact. That's what we want to do. What we've been doing in Georgia, North Carolina, we want to do that all across the country.
Yeah, now when I was a young Democrat myself, let's get my age away a little bit, in the late 60s and early 70s, the University of Georgia by far had the strongest chapter of the young Democrats in this state, and I think that was pretty much true for the Republicans, the young Republicans as well, such as it was in this state in those days. Do you still find college campuses to be the most fertile ground when you're recruiting young Democrats?
I'd say that colleges are phenomenal places to recruit. In 2008, when I was the president of the UGA Young Democrats, we mm-hmm. had unprecedented turnout and outreach. We had a meeting every single week. We were hitting mm-hmm. 100 people at each meeting, between 60 and 100 people. And we were partnering with the Students for Barack Obama to register students on campus, and we registered hundreds and hundreds of students to vote in Athens. That level of excitement and engagement is really just unmatched. I mean, college campuses are great places to recruit. But then I'll also go back and say that the Young Democrats of Atlanta, for example, not only include several college students who are going to school in Atlanta, but have a much broader range. College mm-hmm. students are typically between the 18 and 22 age range, with some grad students and non-traditional students involved as well. But you go to an organization like the Young Democrats of Atlanta, you have a wider range of background, and the Young Democrats of Atlanta is an incredibly effective organization, and they do just amazing work as well. I try to go, as often as I can to their meetings.
Yeah. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to David to get us into some political questions. David?
Oh, yes, and I had my phone muted to keep you from hearing the car alarm going off well away, but I think in the background. Well, Lewis, usually folks want to talk about the Republican side and see what you think of the presidential race. Since you're the YD president, we'll only be fair and ask you about the Democratic side. Give us your thoughts on the Democratic race for the nomination thus far.
Well, we've got – first of all, I know that we're electing a Democrat in 2016. That's absolutely clear. We have there's just no comparison. There's no comparison between our slate of candidates and the Republican slate. I mean, I think a lot of us have seen Republicans in the past, especially in Georgia and sometimes on the national level, being, incredibly good at crowning the king behind the scenes and not taking the fight out publicly. But they're in a complete state of disorganization right now. They can't find that person. They're not doing it. I mean, it's a sight to behold. Whereas on the Democratic side, we've got an incredibly professional slate of candidates that have been doing a great job. I saw four of them speak at the DNC meeting in Minneapolis, and I mean, we have candidates that are ready to be president and ready to lead, and you know, I'm fully confident that we're going to win in November.
Well, I'll go ahead and I still have more questions later, I'm sure, but I'll go ahead and pass it to Catherine. Catherine?
Well, Lewis, you were at the David, is it okay if we talk about the state dinner that both Lewis and I were at last night?
Oh, sure thing.
Absolutely.
Catherine, I'll pass it to you. You get to choose.
Okay. So at the dinner last night, we heard we had video messages from both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Nothing from Martin O'Malley, though, was in the program. I don't know what that was about. But
yeah, I saw that.
I just wondered what your sort of impression of those two messages were.
Well, I think that coming out of the DNC meeting in Minneapolis, I think that Hillary Clinton gives an incredible, just an amazing speech. And I know that in the past, you know, especially looking at the 2008 election, you know, there was a lot of contrast. There was contrast being made between President Obama and Senator Clinton at the time as to, you know, which of these candidates will do a better job at firing up the base. I've got to tell you, Hillary Clinton in Minneapolis, that if that wasn't firing up the base, I don't know what was. It was an incredible speech. And frankly, I think that the two messages we saw last night seemed solid, and it was good that they did their shout outs to Georgia. I think it's pretty clear they're doing a lot of these all across the country and sending a lot of messages. So, but I thought both of them were excellent. Bernie Sanders certainly has a lot of passion, and I noticed he had a bit of a presence there at the dinner last night, as far as supporters, but I'm just glad they're paying attention to Georgia. I mean, I represent a national organization, but my roots are all here. I still live here, and we deserve more attention. We're a big, powerful state, and we can definitely go blue in 2016. So it's good to be getting attention from presidential candidates.
Yeah, well, I'll just I thought that both messages were very indicative of the candidates and their supporters. I thought, you know, Hillary was very or Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton was very dignified and optimistic and poised, I would say. She wasn't shrill, which is something she's been accused of over her entire political career. So I think she's taken that to heart. I think she's trying very hard to be warm and generous. And then I thought Senator Sanders was really, he wasn't shrill, but he was, like you said, he was very passionate, very loud, not very celebratory. Like I thought, Secretary Clinton was, you know, she sort of had she understood the tone of the evening and was, you know, recognized that we were at a party and we were celebrating being Democrats in Georgia. And I think Senator Sanders was a little bit tone deaf to that. I thought maybe his message was more, I'm not criticizing him. It was just a difference in tone. I thought he was more of in a rally kind of tone instead of like a celebration kind of tone.
I noticed that Secretary Clinton name dropped quite a bit, and I don't think Senator Sanders did. I think it was pretty much hello Georgia, and then launching right into the campaign speech, which was good.
Yeah,
very passionate.
I mean, it was fine. It was good to hear from him. It was good to hear from both of them. But I did notice, I thought there was a very distinct difference in the way that they approached their message. But what did you think of the dinner?
I thought the dinner was incredible, and I've been raving about it the past day. It was not only unbelievably well attended. This is what I loved about it was when I was a kid, I was a teenager. I started coming to these things, and I started going to these Democratic dinners. I would be a volunteer, just trying to get a free ticket. So I'd be following somebody around, helping do this or that. And I was just in awe of these things. And actually, I remember, I guess it was the 2008 dinner where at the time Senator Clinton came and spoke, and that thing was enormous. It was so huge. And over the years, I mean, it's been tougher. We've lost a lot of races, and you go to some of these dinners and the rooms get smaller and smaller. They don't book the big room at the World Congress Center. They get, a smaller one that's partitioned off. And that's been fairly disheartening to see. But then last night we were at the Hyatt Regency. They had the big room again, and it was huge. And the energy, the excitement, the people that were there, I thought it was great.
I thought it was great too. I thought the mood was really uplifting. I thought the room was beautiful. It was great to have music. It was really like a party instead of like, I mean, sometimes those things you're like, oh, do I have to go to the dinner? Can I just write a check and not go? And I was glad that there weren't a lot of empty tables. Like sometimes in those big halls, there's like, half the tables in the back are empty, and it's kind of like gloomy almost. But I thought last night was great, and at the same time, we did have some. There was some sadness. We had a memorial to Julian Bond, and then a very touching memorial to Cabral Franklin, who recently passed away. And even in those moments of sadness, I felt like the room was really together and, celebrating those lives. So I think that was really, it was really touching and something that you can't often do in a room that size. But I think they did a really good job of it. So bravo to the DPG and all the people who worked on it. They did a great job.
I agree.
Okay, now we'll pass back to Tim.
All right, let's just stay in Georgia. I'm sure you've heard about the interview that Mayor Reed gave with Atlanta Magazine, and he was asked about the 2018 gubernatorial race, and I'm going to quote him. It's not my plan right now. My plan right now in 2018 is to be in the private sector. He didn't quite shut the door, but he is strongly indicating that he may not run. And that surprised a lot of people. What's your take on it?
Well, I think that Senator Obama spent a lot of time telling people that he wasn't going to run for president before he ran for president. And he took quite a bit. I mean, this is 2015, 3 years out from the next governor's race. I don't think the mayor knows what the political landscape is going to look like. We've got to see what happens in 2016. We're going to have all new DPI all across the state after the Democratic Performance Index. For anybody who doesn't know, that was an indicator of how well a Democrat will do in a given district or area. I mean, that's all going to change after the 2016 race, because we'll have new candidates and we'll have a presidential race, and the landscape is going to change. So, I saw the interview. I looked at the interview and I heard about it. I certainly think that that could very well be his intention. But I think that every candidate and potential candidate is going to be waiting and taking a look at how the landscape may shift and what it's going to look like. And I've got to tell you, pollsters are not going to stop putting Kasim Reed in their polls. When they're and they're doing this. The DGA is not going to stop putting Kasim Reed in their projections.
Yeah.
And
so if you were really looking at this closely, you would say that the key words in his statement were right now.
Yeah, perhaps.
Is that...
I mean, it's simply every candidate, a candidate deciding to run for office, and I've worked a few local campaigns before, and that is an intensely personal, huge decision to make, and it's not just you. It's a decision that you have to make with the community and with the family. I think that he'll weigh it, but if he feels that it's something that he's being called to do, then I certainly think that he may look at it again. And you know, you can't underestimate. We just don't know what it's going to look like in a couple of years. But
I agree with you, Mr. President. I remember very clearly when Richard Nixon said, "You guys won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore." And 6 years later, the man was president. So, yeah, you're right. Let me pass it back to David. I know he's chomping at the bit for some more questions here, David.
Yeah, Tim brought us back to Georgia, and that's kind of where I was going. So it's good Tim got one of those out of the way. But the U.S. Senate race, it comes up first. Now, conventional wisdom says, you know, Johnny Isaacson's a stronger candidate than Saxby Chambliss would have been, than David Perdue as a non-incumbent was. But I kind of have a feeling that Georgia's moving a little more to the middle, a little more to the left in the presidential race, and that there's those races, the presidential and the Senate, are going to come closer to each other. There's not going to be a lot of Clinton, and I'm going to go ahead and tell you, that's who the nominee is going to be. You can't, is your position, but I can as a podcast host. But people aren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton and Johnny Isaacson. Just like I don't think anybody's going to vote for Donald Trump and the Democratic nominee for Senate. There's not going to be a lot of crossover. There'll be some undervote. People may fall off one side or the other. But therefore, that race is going to be a lot closer. Could even see a situation where we go into overtime. Now, of course, that never favors it. And we really hadn't heard much about a candidate until just the past few weeks. Raphael Warnock, who's honestly, I think his church is more famous than he is, Ebenezer Baptist Church, the church of both Martin Luther King Sr. and Jr., where they held the pulpit. But he is looking more and more like a candidate. Lewis, if you know of any other possible candidates that you can tell about, do tell. Otherwise, just kind of assess Reverend Warnock's chances.
Absolutely, and I'm thrilled to take this question because I've been having this conversation with folks quite a bit over the last few weeks. Is Senator Isaacson a strong candidate? Certainly. He's an incumbent. He's won twice. Sure. I mean, there's this general anecdotal idea that Johnny Isaacson is unbeatable, but I've got to tell you, that's hogwash. I mean, Johnny Isaacson is just a Republican. That's all. He's just a Republican. And politics is math. They're numbers. Anybody can be beaten. You take a look at what happened in Wisconsin. I'll use a converse opinion or converse example. You take a look at, like, Russ Feingold in Wisconsin. I don't know what the dynamics were on the local level, but Russ Feingold, when he was beaten, was hugely popular all across the country. I mean, just a Democratic juggernaut, and he lost. And now he's obviously coming back and running. But Wisconsin was an incredibly, incredibly Democratic state, and they lost a very popular incumbent Democratic U.S. senator. Georgia is not anywhere near as Republican as the Republicans would like to make us believe, especially at the state level. In 2008, we got 47% of the vote in an open presidential year, 47% of the vote. And any political operative anywhere will tell you, if you have a DPI of 47%, then that is competitive. I don't care who the Republican is. I don't care if it's Johnny Isaacson or somebody else. He's just a Republican. Of course we can beat him, as long as we have the kind of campaign that we need to do it, as long as we have a strong campaign. And Reverend Warnock, I've got to tell you, I saw him at the dinner last night, and I think as far as a candidates come, I think Reverend Warnock can be an incredibly strong candidate. I think that he can. This is somebody who has experience at motivating people and inspiring people and networking and working across the aisle and bringing people together. And I absolutely think that this is someone who can put together a strong campaign, one that can really challenge the Republicans, really challenge the right wing, and give them a run for their money. And in a presidential year, Lord knows. I think that Reverend Warnock, I haven't heard of anybody else running for U.S. Senate. I think Reverend Warnock, should he choose to do it, would be a phenomenal standard bearer for us. And I've got to say one more thing. Like, Isaacson's had a pretty easy go of it, his last two elections. I mean, you know, we put up some candidates who, you know, were running very strong campaigns, but, you know, it was hard for them to raise money, and it was hard for them to really hit Isaacson, you know, the way he needed to. I think Reverend Warnock has it. I think he's got that drive. I think he's got, he may have the ability to do that. So, absolutely. Do I think Isaacson can be beaten? Absolutely. Do I think Warnock can do it? Definitely.
Yes, I just think that, you know, there's a Democratic baseline in a presidential year, and it's somewhere in the, I mean, you know, somebody could put their name on a ballot, never leave their house to campaign, and if they had a Democrat, a D beside their name in a presidential year, they're going to get in the low to mid-40s. Then you start to campaign a little bit, and you do a little better. Now, of course, that 45 to 50, that little portion of the vote is a whole other animal. That's the hardest 5% to get of the whole deal. But and, of course, you get into that overtime, and, of course, money will get poured in on both sides. You may lose it, but, I mean, just anytime, just like sports, if you force somebody into overtime or into a runoff, you gain a measure of respect. And people say, hey, you didn't waste your time. You didn't run a bad campaign, that kind of
right.
thing.
Nobody.
Well, Catherine, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, nobody ever said that Jim Martin shouldn't have run in 2008. He did. He put Saxby into a runoff. He did an incredible
yeah.
job. I mean, Jim Martin was their standard bearer. Nobody said he shouldn't have done it. I mean, we did a great job in 08. We can do it again in 2016.
Yes. Catherine, we've got about 2 minutes. Any quick questions for Lewis?
Oh, well, I just wanted to ask him if there was anything that we didn't mention that he thinks we should be thinking about, or something, a message that we didn't get.
All I'd say is that the Young Democrats of Georgia, it's an incredible group. I led them for 2 years. If you know anybody in this state, you know, between the age of 14, 39, that can that wants to get involved in politics, talk to the Young Democrats of Georgia. Talk to Richard McDaniel, who's the president, and get them involved. We're looking. The Young Democrats of Georgia is looking for new members, and having a strong state chapter here will make my job a lot easier at the national level. So.
Yes. Well, Lewis, we thank you for joining us tonight on the Kudzu Vine. That was Lewis Elrod, Young Democrats of America president.
Thanks, Lewis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Yes. Yes, and we could blather on for all of about 50 seconds before our hour window's up. So why don't we just go ahead and quit early, if you will. It's been the Kudzu Vine. Night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common